Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. There's a major inquiry into the Iraq War going on in Britain today, with high-profile testimony from the British leader who partnered with President George W. Bush in the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Former Prime Minister Tony Blair was feisty and unapologetic as he faced hours of questioning about his decision to go to war to end the threat posed by Saddam Hussein.
It's really, really important, I think, to understand this so far as understanding the decision I took, and frankly would take again. If there was any possibility that he could develop weapons of mass destruction, we should stop him. That was my view. That was my view then. That's my view now.
Blair also denied striking a covert deal with Bush to invade Iraq 1 year before the war began. And Blair told investigators that the 9/11 terror attacks in the United States dramatically changed perceptions of the threat posed by the former Iraqi president. In Britain, negative perceptions of Blair seem set in stone. He's been called George Bush's lapdog, and protesters outside the hearing are blasting Blair as a war criminal and shouting, "Jail Tony." The BBC's political affairs correspondent Rob Watson has been inside the hearing room. And Rob, here in the United States, the Iraq War has somewhat receded from the headlines. But in Britain, this is being very closely watched. You called it history-making.
Well, it is history in the making in the sense that no former prime minister has ever had to defend live on television, the internet and radio, a decision to go to war. So by its very nature, it is high political drama and certainly history in the making. I should say that until the Iraq inquiry, probably somewhat like the United States, Iraq is not so much in the headlines in Britain because, of course, British troops withdrew last summer. But, of course, the inquiry and some of the people that have appeared before it have put it straight back in there.
So you say that this is a first for Great Britain and its government. How exactly has Blair been defending himself over the course of the day?
The two words that come to mind are robust and defiant. He has not at any point shown any form of contrition or uncertainty about what he did. He has continued to defend vigorously the decision to back George W. Bush in the war against Iraq.
Well, Blair's Attorney General Lord Goldsmith told investigators on Wednesday that he told Tony Blair that regime change was not a legal reason for going to war. How did Blair respond to that today?
Well, the issue was complicated in essentially Tony Blair said that at the end the Attorney General had said that the war was lawful, and that was very much his position. I have to say that on some of the issues that most people in Britain and no doubt around the world would consider the most controversial, that is the decision to go to war, the intelligence case made for war, the legality of it, Tony Blair was absolutely defiant, and in many ways I don't think the panel really caused him very many problems.
And yet in this inquiry we're finding that there's still many outstanding questions about, of course, the run-up to the war. I mean, Britain's former ambassador to Washington told investigators earlier this week that an agreement to go to war had been, quote, signed in blood by President Bush and Prime Minister Blair at a meeting at Bush's Texas ranch in April of 2002, I believe, a full year before the war. Blair told investigators, and we're going to hear this, that he gave a commitment to deal with Saddam Hussein.
What he took from that was exactly what he should have taken, which is that if it came to military action, because there was no way of dealing with this diplomatically, we would be with him. And that was absolutely clear, because as I'd set out publicly, not privately, we had to confront this issue. It could be confronted by sanctions. It could be confronted by UN inspections. Or alternatively, it would have to be confronted by force.
Now, of course, the point that Tony Blair has been trying to make is we had hoped that the UN route would work, but he said, frankly, he, like the United States, was always skeptical that Saddam Hussein would ever comply with UN resolutions, or as he put it, he believed in the American judgment that a leopard was unlikely to change its spots.
And another outstanding issue remaining here in the United States is the allegation that Saddam Hussein was connected to the attacks on 9/11. The Bush administration made that link. Of course, now we know that there was no link. Was there any indication, did Blair say that he disagreed with the president on that at any time?
He didn't say so much that he disagreed specifically with President Bush, but that the United Kingdom had made it clear all along that it had found no evidence, there wasn't any evidence of links between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. But what he did say was, because he tied an awful lot of his testimony to the events of 9/11, saying that Britain, like the United States, suddenly felt that it had a much lower tolerance for regimes, for unstable regimes, for, as he called them, rogue, evil regimes that had weapons of mass destruction.
And, Rob, finally, I have to ask, this is the third time the British government has done an inquiry into the Iraq War. The first inquiry found that the government did not, quote, sex up an intelligence dossier on Saddam Hussein's weapon of mass destruction. And then the second inquiry found there were flaws in pre-war intelligence. I mean, in this third inquiry, what's the point? What's the aim of the commission?
Well, actually, you know, by some calculations, this is the fifth inquiry, if you include a couple of parliamentary committees, like the equivalent of Senate and House committees that have looked at these things. The difference, I suppose, with this one is that, for a start, the hearings are being held in public, but it's more really to do with the scope and range of this inquiry. The other ones have been quite focused. This is looking all the way back from 2001, all the way through to the eventual withdrawal of British troops in July 2009. Now, does that mean the scope of it, that people are any less sceptical about, oh, well, this is going to be another government whitewash? Well, probably not. But on the other hand, what the inquiry has been saying to the people of Britain is, well, hang on, wait until you see our report.
And finally, if I understand correctly, this is not a criminal investigation. So what effect could the outcome of the inquiry have on Tony Blair or British policy going forward?
Well, two things. I think for Tony Blair, this is hugely important personally. This is about his legacy. This is about his place in history. And, of course, that matters to him because he still wants to play an important role on the world stage. In terms of British politics, although it's probably true that most people in Britain made up their minds about the Iraq War a long, long time ago, the very fact that you're having all these headlines again, you're having the appearance of Mr. Blair, will remind the majority of voters about a war that they didn't like. And maybe that will influence the way they vote in a general election expected in the next few months.
That's BBC's political affairs correspondent Rob Watson in London. He's covering the Chilcot inquiry that's looking into lessons learned from the Iraq War. Rob, thank you for your time.
Good to be with you again.
Well, that's the latest on British inquiries into Iraq. But what about the other war that the United States is currently engaged in, Afghanistan? Well, with us in studio is Rory Stewart. He famously crossed Afghanistan on foot and wrote about it in his book, The Places in Between. Stewart now heads the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. And we asked him here today to talk about his January essay in the New York Review of Books on what could work in Afghanistan. Rory Stewart, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
So before we actually get to Afghanistan, we're reminded that you served as a British administrative officer in southern Iraq, and you also wrote about that in The Prince of the Marshes. So what do you make of what we just heard on Tony Blair's testimony today?
It's fascinating that the British are still so focused, above all, on the legality of the war. There's so much mess, so much catastrophe there on the ground. And rather than focusing on all the almost inevitable failures of implementation, all the damage that we did, the British still seem to be fascinated by the question of whether or not Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and whether or not Tony Blair was breaking international law. It's bizarre.
So it seems possibly too much backward-looking to you?
I think it's missing the main point of these kinds of interventions, which is that we are frequently trying to do, that's the United States and its allies, things that we can't do, things that we lack the power, the knowledge, or the legitimacy to achieve.
Well, that actually brings us to what you wrote about in the New York Review of Books, which we'll get to in a moment, because those same issues occur in Afghanistan, as you well know. But there was also a lot of news in Afghanistan this week, a brazen Taliban attack in the heart of a major city in the south just today. And that comes on the heels of President Hamid Karzai's announcement in London of a new plan for reconciliation with the Taliban. He seems to be going farther than what a lot of Western officials had in mind, offering money and possibly even amnesty to members of the Taliban. So what do you make of what Karzai has in mind?
I think Karzai has acknowledged that the Taliban are a serious force, that there are many Afghans who sympathize with the Taliban, particularly in the south and east of the country, and that we need to have some kind of political solution involving reconciliation. In other words, there may have been people around 2-3 years ago who imagined that you could simply beat the Taliban, eliminate them, and that you'd never have to deal with them again. Karzai is clearly not one of those. He sees them as a force in Afghan politics and a force that needs to be addressed, needs to be reconciled with if we're going to move forward.
Well, some kind of political reconciliation would possibly require legitimacy in the current Afghan government. So how do you think Do you think that President Karzai is likely to succeed? Because I know you've said before that he has very little legitimacy as the government in Afghanistan, and even some Taliban leaders, I understand, were very skeptical. They said they've seen this kind of thing before.
That's right. On the other hand, the Taliban themselves lack legitimacy. So you're dealing with a situation in which both parties are relatively weak. The Taliban are not able to take over the country. They're not going to be able to seize something like Kabul. They're very unpopular, particularly in the north and the centre, and they discredit themselves when they're in power. So we're in a situation in which the Karzai government, as you say, is relatively weak, but the Taliban need to acknowledge that they're not going to be able to take over the country either. And if we can get both sides to acknowledge the situation as it stands, we may be able to get some kind of reconciliation.
So that brings us to what you wrote in the New York Review of Books, basically regarding what to do in Afghanistan and questions of the Karzai government's legitimacy. You even say the legitimacy of the Taliban itself. So I suppose in a nutshell, what would you say is the way forward in Afghanistan? Is a troop surge, as President Obama has called for, a good part of such a plan?
I don't think that was necessary. In fact, I think the urgent requirement in Afghanistan is to try to define a moderate long-term policy in the country. The danger of troop surges is that they create a backlash, they create opposition domestically, they increase the likelihood of withdrawal. As you saw, President Obama was forced to suggest a date for a drawdown as part of the price for asking for more troops. Afghanistan's problems are problems which will take decades to solve. And above all, we need, in order to get a political solution, to give an impression of some kind of permanence. So the answer, I believe, would have been to think about a much more moderate policy involving a fraction of the number of troops we have at the moment, but over a longer period.
When you say permanent, do you mean some kind of permanent military presence?
I'd imagine that there would probably be some element of a small military presence remaining there on the ground. In other words, I'm not somebody who's black or white about this. I think, in fact, one of the dangers of the whole debate is that people lurch between pushing for troop increases or withdrawal. I believe we would have been safer to remain roughly where we were 3-4 years ago, with just a few troops on the ground and thinking about projects which, above all, have a political objective, not a military objective.
That sounds a little familiar. I mean, it's hard to get around the idea that it sounds like having troops permanently or even a diplomatic presence permanently in Afghanistan, and yet you also write, at the same time, with no real guarantee of success. So how do you square the two?
But the answer, of course, is that it's a very risky, unstable situation. It's not a country that anybody can predict, explain, or control. And in fact, people's attempts to do that have generally gone wrong. So we're looking at a public policy proposal where we try to look at what's affordable, what we can do, and we need to weigh it up against our other priorities elsewhere in the world.
We're speaking with Rory Stewart of the Carr Center for Human Rights at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He walked across Afghanistan and wrote about it in The Places in Between. He knows the country well. We're going to hear a lot more about what he thinks is the way forward in Afghanistan. And later on, we'll also ask him about his own jumps into politics in the United Kingdom. That's all when we come back. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rory Stewart about Afghanistan and the news this week that Hamid Karzai's government is going to reach out to the Taliban. We'll also talk with him more about what he believes is the proper way forward in Afghanistan. Stewart heads the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University, and his book about his journey by foot across Afghanistan is The Places in Between. And Rory, we were just talking about how you believe a combination of military and diplomatic presence in Afghanistan from the United States, and I believe the international community as well, is a key part of how to rebuild the country or to go forward. But can you give us what you envision in a little more detail? Because this sounds like a project of generations.
I think we need to look at Afghanistan as a very poor, fragile, traumatized country. We do have an obligation towards Afghans, towards their human rights, towards many, many poor people in that country whose lives we, of course, have made more complicated over the last 30 years of interference. But that doesn't mean a blank check. It means trying to do what we can do rather than fantasizing about what we feel we ought to be able to do. We also, of course, do have national security interests in that country. We would ideally like Afghanistan to be more stable, more prosperous, more humane than it is today, because we think that would help us in relation to Pakistan. It would help us in relation to our own counter-terrorist agendas. But to come down to the bottom line is Afghanistan is not the be-all and end-all. It's not the only country we have to deal with in the world. It's one of perhaps 40 countries that we need to think about. So instead of getting into a mindset where we get so ambitious that we begin plunging in almost unlimited resources in an attempt to do the impossible, we need to think in Afghanistan and elsewhere about what we can do to help Afghans, what we can do to help local people, and what we can do to secure our own national security interests in a moderate, contained fashion. And that probably involves quite a patient and quite a long-term presence.
Do you have an example in history where such a patient and long-term presence has actually worked?
Yes, I think if you look at what's worked in the Balkans, the best thing about what happened in the Balkans was not troop numbers or troop presence, but the movement really in the end towards the European Union. And you can see a bit of this in Turkey too. These are countries which came out of warfare and which are now in a much more settled position than they were in 10 or 15 years ago. Afghanistan, of course, is starting from a much, much lower base, and therefore the odds against success in Afghanistan, Afghanistan basically is much more difficult to deal with than countries like the Balkans or Turkey. But I think if we look around the world, the idea that development programs, the idea that political, diplomatic means could allow the United States to help other countries is something that's worth fighting for.
Well, it seems though that this patient and light touch strategy just leaves so much to chance. I mean, for example, what about the ongoing problem of Al-Qaeda?
The world is about chance. It's about risk.
And it seems
we
that,
can't
but the
pretend.
American public doesn't seem much in the mood of taking those kinds of risks at the moment.
The American public, unfortunately, is going to have to deal with Yemen. It's going to have to deal with Somalia. It may have to deal in the future with much larger and more difficult countries, Iran, Egypt, Iraq, China. The American public cannot put itself into a situation which, in order to avoid any risk at all, it involves putting 100,000 troops, which it can barely afford, into Afghanistan and leaving itself exposed on every other flank. We need to be mature.
So
we need to understand the world is uncertain, and we need to understand that we may not be able to do all the things we want to do.
So then how do you propose that President Obama present to the United States, to the American people, yes, we're going to risk Afghanistan being a failed state if we take this light touch. We're going to risk Al-Qaeda still being there,
possibly strengthening again. He needs to point out that even putting in more troops will not guarantee that Afghanistan doesn't become, in inverted commas, a failed state. Even putting in more troops doesn't guarantee that Afghanistan isn't going to have association with counterterrorism. That which we can achieve in Afghanistan, we can achieve with a relatively light troop presence. Putting in more and more troops is not going to make us any safer. It's not going to achieve these grander objectives, because we're never going to have enough to be able to dominate and occupy that whole country. It's a fantasy.
Do you really think it's worth the risk? Because I guess what I'm asking is, the other option is what many other people have called for, is an all-out troop withdrawal and letting the Afghans and surrounding nations, you know, do what they may.
Well, this seems a little bit paradoxical. I mean, you seem to be suggesting on the one hand that you can't tolerate the idea of a light footprint because it's too risky, and therefore you're advocating withdrawal. I would have thought withdrawal was considerably more risky. In other words, a situation in which there was no U.S. presence at all, in which we had absolutely no leverage, we had no special forces, no intelligence operatives on the ground, no attempt to achieve any kind of political negotiation, seems to me to be worse. So I would have thought before we withdrew, we might like to try to see what we can do with a more conventional diplomatic and political presence on the ground.
It's not necessarily my opinion, but I do take your point. However, what I'm trying to understand is, I suppose, a question that may be going through many people's minds who are hearing what you're saying, that, you know, on the one hand, as you've said, the strong-arm notion of a huge troop surge was not necessarily a good idea. On the other hand, total withdrawal from Afghanistan, this vague in-between with an uncertain outcome, with allowing possible resurgence, possible failed state. How is it that we can politically tell the American people this is the best way to go?
By talking, I think, about other risks and other priorities, explaining that we don't have unlimited resources, that we need to match our resources to our priorities, and remind people that in our everyday lives, we don't imagine that we can have a situation of either total withdrawal or massive increase. In other words, if we're dealing with our own families, we accept a situation in which we allow people some independence, some responsibility, some autonomy. We don't try to micromanage every element of our family's lives, nor should we be attempting to do that in Afghanistan. We should be trying to support the positive, diminish the negative, and help that country to be a better place in 30 years' time than it is today.
That's Rory Stewart. He's head of the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He walked across Afghanistan and wrote about it in The Places in Between. And he runs a nonprofit development project also in Afghanistan. Rory, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Well, we have a follow-up on a story we brought to you yesterday about conflicting accounts surrounding the deaths of three detainees at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in 2006. The Pentagon and the Department of Justice concluded the deaths were suicides, but yesterday we spoke with Scott Horton, contributing editor for Harper's Magazine. He interviewed soldiers on guard duty the night of the deaths, and the soldiers' eyewitness accounts led Horton to believe the detainees may have been victims of homicide. Today we have a statement from the Department of Justice. Spokeswoman Laura Sweeney writes, quote, "The department took this matter very seriously. A number of department attorneys and agents extensively and thoroughly reviewed the allegations and found no evidence of wrongdoing. It's here and now."
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Remember when you were a kid in elementary school and you wriggled and couldn't wait to finish lunch so you could dash out to recess and play? Well, a growing number of schools are beginning to think that eat and run may not be the best thing for student health or education. So they're swapping lunch and recess. Joining us now is Sarah Hartley. She's principal of North Ranch Elementary School in Scottsdale, Arizona. And Sarah, you have a program there that has scheduled recess before lunch instead of recess after lunch. Why'd you do that?
In Arizona, it's very warm. We have a lot of hot days. And so having kids out running around after they've eaten, we saw that there were a number of children that would go to the nurse for stomach aches or headaches. And we wanted to see if we could reverse that trend by reversing the activity and having the activity before they actually ate.
I guess that makes sense when you think that no one ever advises you to go running after having a huge midday meal. And so now, after allowing them to go outside and run around and play and then come back in to sit down and have their lunch, are you seeing any benefits? Have you noticed any benefits in the cafeteria?
Actually, we've seen three major benefits. We actually took data and found that about 40% fewer visits to the nurse after the lunchtime occurred with stomach aches and headaches. The second benefit was that we, as you said in the intro, kids get excited about going to recess and didn't always eat their meal completely. We find that if they're out running around and playing, they come in, they're hungry. And so there is no hurry to eat their lunch. And the third area was kind of surprising to us. When the children would come in directly to the classroom from recess, there would need to be a cool down period, a time that they needed to kind of get back into academic mode. And we found that coming in from the recess to the lunchroom enabled that cool down period, so that when they were released from their lunch, we see that the children are ready to learn. So we feel like we have gained 15 or 20 minutes a day academically, because it was more difficult to get the kids engaged and on task if they were attending to academics directly from the playground as opposed to coming in from the lunchroom.
Were there any things that you had to set up in order to transition to this new schedule?
We needed to make sure that, obviously, when they came in from the playground to the lunchroom, their hands needed to be washed. And typically, that would have been done in the classroom before going to the lunchroom. So we installed sanitizers and trained the children to make sure that their hands were sanitized before they ate their lunch.
Let me ask you, though, I've read that some educational professionals have raised concerns that doing this lunch and recess switch might not work for, say, poorer school districts where many kids may not get breakfast in the morning and they don't want their students to wait so long before having their first proper meal of the day. Is that something that you had to address there at your school?
No, in our state, children can have breakfast here at school, but also it's how you arrange the schedule. So instead of a child going to recess at 11:20, for example, and then coming in at 10 minutes till 12 to eat, you would just have them go to recess at 11 o'clock and go in at a little earlier to eat. So it's not an issue of having them wait longer. It's looking at your schedule and seeing how you can arrange that.
Okay. Well, Sarah, would you ever consider going back to the old schedule where recess followed lunch?
Actually, I would not. We've been doing this for 9 years now. We see such benefits that, and it makes so much common sense that I think that it would be not advantageous for the children to switch back. So this is the schedule that we'll keep, and I encourage others to think about it.
And I guess it didn't cost the school a penny to do this?
Not a penny.
Well, that's Sarah Hartley. She's principal of North Ranch Elementary School in Scottsdale, Arizona. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, when we come back, we'll have the latest from Haiti and a visit to a grade school here in the United States that's keeping a strong bond with its sister school in Haiti by exchanging books. Back in 30 seconds, it's Here and Now. The already desperate medical situation in Haiti is becoming more urgent. Aid workers say basic medical supplies like antibiotics and painkillers are running dangerously low. UN officials say it's impossible to get medicine and doctors to everyone in need because the country's infrastructure remains in ruins. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports today that a lack of resources, like trucks, is slowing down the U.S. military's effort to get food and water to survivors. We contacted Sergeant Caleb Barrio of the 82nd Airborne Division in Haiti, and he says soldiers are learning to speed up the process with the help of Haitians.
We're letting the people of the town right there to actually disseminate all the food, and they're deciding who gets the food and who needs it the most. It's gotten very streamlined and very proficient. All we need to do is deliver the food, get it down there, and they actually do the rest.
He also says that the 82nd Airborne Division is glad to be of service in Haiti. The humanitarian mission is, he says, a welcome change from combat missions he served in Iraq.
I'd have to say it's a breath of fresh air. Going from combat to humanitarian, we're doing a lot of good things here, and there isn't the stress of trying to be getting shot at or anything like that. So I think a lot of the soldiers, I'd have to say, they all feel a breath of fresh air in knowing that we're here to help and doing good.
That was Sergeant Caleb Barrio. He spoke with us from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Well, school children here in the United States have been looking for ways to help victims of the earthquake in Haiti. But students at the Fairweather Street School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, already have close ties with one school, the Matinwa Community Learning Center on Lagunov Island, west of Port-au-Prince. The two schools have a teacher exchange program and started the Mother Tongue Book Project, an exchange of books written by students in their native languages, English and Creole. Here and Now's George Hicks visited the Fairweather Street School and met these fifth and sixth graders.
I'm Alia. I'm writing about the everyday life at our school because I thought it would be interesting for them to, like, know how our school is different from theirs.
I'm Noah, and I'm writing about music and, like, why it's important to me. I'd like to hear, like, what most of them listen to.
I'm Ava, and I'm writing about me being Jewish because I would want to know what traditions they did there in terms of, like, religion.
But first the books get translated, so they can actually read them.
And learn to read in their native language. Now, while most Haitian schools teach exclusively in French, at Matinwa, students receive all their instruction in Creole. But when the Fairweather teachers first visited Matinwa, they noticed a lack of Creole language books.
If you go to their library in the school, it's one small room, and they have a whole bunch of bookshelves with books in French and English, and then one shelf with the Haitian books.
That's Lauren Mueller. She teaches first and second grade at Fairweather. She says the Matinwa students' need for books to read in Creole and the desire of students at both schools to make a personal connection led to the Mother Tongue Books project.
It was an impromptu thing where the first one that we did was with our kids in first and second grade interviewing a teacher that had come here. And we wrote it in English and we wrote it in Creole. Then I guess it dawned on a group of us that that would be a great project to continue. So we took original stories that our kids had written here and translated them and we brought them down. And they were just received really well by the kids down there.
Mueller says the vast cultural differences between the two schools make translating their respective experiences difficult, a point not lost on these Fairweather students.
You have to think about if, like, the words can get translated and still make sense in Haitian Creole.
People in Haiti might not really know what snow is or what it's like.
Well, I really like video games, but I thought, wouldn't it be weird for someone to write about video games to someone who never even heard of video games?
And some of the difficulties these American and Haitian students have understanding one another lie beyond language. The Fairweather Street School is a small private school. Most of the students come from affluent families. I asked Ed Q, head of school, how his younger students could possibly grasp the abject poverty of Haiti.
No matter what socioeconomic level you're in, very few Americans would understand that level of poverty. So what we're trying to emphasize is not that they're poor, but what are the similarities?
One example, Q says, is in the idea of play. While Matinwa students usually make do with just a soccer ball at recess, he says Fairweather students don't always appreciate all the recreational facilities available to them.
So we tried this experiment this fall where we gave kids objects that don't have a specific purpose, boards, and 4x4s and ropes and pieces of PVC piping. And we said, these are your play toys. And part of that came from the idea that in Haiti, kids are using their imagination in lots of different ways. And it's been great to see what our kids do with it. Build bridges, seesaws, made their own rope swings.
As the current semester began, teacher Lauren Mueller and her colleagues were busy putting together the first batch of books for Matinwa's first and second graders.
The morning after the earthquake just so happened to coincide with us finishing translating the first six books that we had just received a couple weeks before from Matinwa. Then we, you know, when we talked about the earthquake with the kids, it gave them a kind of some people to think about. And now we're in the process of kind of deciding what we're going to do to help our friends.
And now, as the fifth and sixth graders at Fairweather write their books, they're also thinking about what else they can do for their Haitian counterparts.
In this class, we're coming up with some ideas to raise money to send to Haiti. One of them was a bake sale.
Since there was just like the big earthquake, it's like even more important that we're writing these books and do a good job on them, because I think it'll show people there on Matinwa, on the island, that people still care about them and understand that.
And I think now it's more important than ever to keep that connection we have between Fairweather and the school in Matinwa, because if we lose what little connections we have, you know, there's not much we can do.
Those are students at the Fairweather School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, sharing their stories and thoughts with Here and Now's George Hicks. By the way, the Matinwa Community Learning Center was damaged in the earthquake, but classes are continuing in an outside courtyard. You can see photos of the Mother Tongue books and their wonderful student authors at our website, hereandnow.org. And before we go today, we will take a close look at the painting that put John Singer Sargent on the map as one of America's great artists. Back in a moment, you're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back. American painter John Singer Sargent was a lifelong bachelor with no offspring that we know of. Instead, he left the world his art. But as museum curator Erica Hirschler writes in the new book, Sargent's Daughters, Sargent's paintings were, in a sense, his children. And one of his most famous works is of four little girls. Florrie, Jane, Issa, and Julia Boyt are the girls in white pinafores in The Daughters of Edward Darley Boyt. It was painted in 1882 and now hangs in Boston's Museum of Fine Arts. We went there recently and found that the painting still has a powerful draw on adults and children. Throughout our conversation with Hirschler, families entered the hushed gallery and walked right up to the luminous image of the littlest Boyt girl.
His mothers always bring their children right up to Julia. It's so much fun because she's so accessible. And people use that figure that's painted so close to us to engage their children because she's at child height. And she's so beautifully painted and so much in our space.
To see what the families find so alluring, go to our website, hereandnow.org, for detailed images of the Daughters of Edward Darley Boyt. You'll get a better sense about why, as Erica Hirschler tells us, an unorthodox painting of four little girls made John Singer Sargent one of the most powerful artists of his time.
It's a big square painting. It's almost 8 feet square. And lost within its shadowy spaces are these four little girls dressed in white and two enormous vases, blue and white porcelain vases.
And these girls are all sisters. They're sisters in the Boyt family. And one of the fascinating things about them to me, as Sargent's arranged them, is that they're not really connected in the space. They're all doing slightly different things.
One critic, when the painting was first exhibited, called it Four Corners in a Void because they found it so bizarre that everything was so disconnected from each other. It's almost like the girls had been playing a game and somebody yelled, "Stop!" and they all stopped wherever they happened to be.
When you first saw this painting or got to know it, what is it that drew you into that world?
I think I really responded to the mystery of it because it's not clear what the girls are doing or what their relationship is with one another. They don't really look at each other or tell us a story, and I think I found that ambiguity very appealing.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the Boyt family. I mean, who are these four little girls, and how did Sargent know them?
Sargent was a friend of the Boyt family. The Boyts were from Boston. Edward Darley Boyt was a Harvard-trained lawyer who gave up the law for a career in art. He really wanted to be a painter. And his wife, Mary Louisa Cushing, who was the daughter of a very wealthy China trade merchant who had grown up in the lap of luxury in the Boston area. And the two of them married during the Civil War and soon after that traveled to Europe, fell in love with it, and decided pretty much to live their lives abroad. And when this painting was made, they were living in Paris.
So how is it that Sargent decided to make this painting of these four little girls?
One of the most intriguing mysteries about this painting is we know absolutely nothing about the circumstances of the commission. Often we know that parents might have hired Sargent or another painter to make images of their children. In this case, there's no documentation at all that I've been able to find. There are no letters, there's no bill of sale, there's no correspondence that indicates whether this was in fact even a commission or not, or whether Sargent came to the Boyt's house one day, saw the girls running around in the apartment and said, aha, that's something that would make a fabulous picture. I rather suspect that the Boyts asked Sargent to paint their girls, but then let him do it any way that he wanted to, because it's so unusual as a portrait, partly because you can't even see the faces of all of the girls.
Where is Sargent in his career at this time, before he did this painting?
The astonishing thing to me, and maybe it becomes more astonishing the older I get, is that Sargent was 26 years old when he painted this. Amazing. He was really at the very beginning of his career. He'd already painted some great things, including the magnificent El Jaleo, the Spanish dancer that's now in the collection of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. But this was his next big salon picture, the next picture he showed at that important annual exhibition.
How was this painting received when it was presented in the Parisian Salon?
Well, some people were very, very perplexed by it, and in fact couldn't even believe that it was being presented as a portrait, because it was so unusual for a portrait. Other people found it very modern and interesting and enjoyed that unconventionality of it. But in general, it was one of the paintings that was most talked about, but not necessarily entirely favorably.
Did it have the effect that Sargent wanted on his career? Did it elevate him into that sort of primary rank of painters at the time?
Absolutely. Anytime you got the number of critics to respond to your painting in this salon exhibition that might include thousands of pictures, if yours was the one that was singled out, that was a good thing.
There is an air of mystery to this painting, as you said, not only in its composition and its execution and what we see, but also we don't fully know the circumstances of its commission. Is there an equal air of mystery about its subject matter? What do we know about these four girls?
We know quite a lot about the four girls, but not enough to really feel that we have a solid portrait of what their lives were like. I think that they remain somewhat mysterious because they never turned out to be women of great notoriety or accomplishment. They are, like many 19th century women, lost a little bit in the shadows of history.
What kind of responses do people have to this painting, whether they've ever heard of it or not?
People have very emotional attachments to it. Whether they know anything about Sargent or know anything about the girls doesn't really matter. One scholar who has written quite a lot about the power of art relates a story about a woman coming into the gallery every time she comes to Boston and weeping in front of it, never able to explain exactly what quality it is, whether it's wistfulness or sadness or memories that make her cry in front of it, or whether it's simply the beauty of it that makes her cry. Often it's very simple. One person told me about coming in with her sisters and always coming to see this picture because they wanted to know whether they were as big as Issa yet or whether they were as big as Jane yet. So it could be very much about one's own relationship with one's own family, or this is a talisman of growing up. Other people respond to it for different reasons, but everybody seems to have a very personal relationship with it, which I find fascinating.
So, as an art historian, does it bother you how much we don't know about this painting?
Of course I'd love to know. As a scholar and a historian, I'd love to know. But at the same time, I think this painting is so much about ambiguity and secrets that somehow I like the fact that it still has some secrets.
Erica Hirschler is Kroll's Senior Curator of American Painting at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts. Her new book is Sargent's Daughters, The Biography of a Painting. To see the daughters of Edward Darley Boyd, go to our website, hereandnow.org, where you can also take a detailed tour of Hirschler's favorite features of the painting. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robin Young will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.